The following message is by Pastor Andrew Beddow, pastor of First Baptist Church of Orchard, Texas. More information on First Baptist Church Orchard can be found at fbcorchard.com.
All right. Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Dear sweet Jesus, God, thank you for your word. Thank you for communicating your truth to us. God, I ask that you would open our hearts up to the reading of the word this morning. And I ask these things in your holy name. Amen. Please be seated. This morning in Sunday school, those of you who missed Sunday school, you missed really interesting discussions like this. We were talking about the security arrangements at my house. See, I have kind of a PTSD crazy nutcase thing going on where I've got to check the perimeter before we go to bed every night, or I can't go to sleep. I have to make sure that the alarm's set, the doors are locked, the firearms are ready, the fields of fire are set up, claymores are all ready, and I've got the handles and everything. You know, mines are out. I don't really know why I do this. It's kind of an internal, I've got to feel safe thing. And in my mind, I'm on a hair trigger, right? I'm ready to go. Somebody breaches the perimeter, and I'm ready to do some damage. The problem is, I've been out of practice for probably 8 years now. And even when I was in practice, I wasn't that good. And I don't wake up well. So there's nobody on fire watch in the house, it's just me. And the other night we had an incident. It was probably 2 o'clock in the morning, and I heard this horrendous boom out in the front yard. And because I don't wake up well, I woke up and I was like, "Why are they dropping off a storage locker at 3 o'clock in the morning?" And then I heard a knock, knock, knock at the door, and I was like, and I came up, I was like, "Oh, bad things are happening." And it took me like 5 minutes to try to, you know, get the gun out of the safe. And I didn't know what I was doing. And I was using the wrong hand. And I was in my underwear. And it was really bad. So finally, I was like, you know, this isn't working. And if you know, intruders are going to kill me, at least I want to be wearing pants. So I put on some pants. And I went out there. You know, told all my plans are gone. You know, all my criteria and all this stuff, it's out the window. And I go to the door, and there's this 20-year-old kid looking at me with this sheepish expression on his face, and he's saying, "Oh, sir, hit your car." And I was like, "Oh, man, you gotta be kidding me. It's like 20 degrees outside." So I go outside in my sweatpants and my little sweatshirt, and it's 20 degrees outside, and sure enough, this guy had come around the corner and had hit my car. Now, he said he was going 10 miles an hour down the street, but I don't think that's true, because he had bent the frame on my truck and just blew up my tire and all four airbags deployed on his car, and it was really bad deal. And all I'm doing is thinking there, as I'm looking at this kid, two things are going through my mind. Number one, I need to call the police. And number two, I looked at the expression on his face, and it was an expression that I had worn many, many times in my life.
And he over and over and over again kept asking me, please don't call the cops. I don't want to go to jail. I have warrants. And if you call the cops, they're going to haul me away. He was asking me for mercy. He was standing there in the street asking me for mercy.
And as a Christian, as Christians, we have a very special relationship with mercy. We have an obligation to mercy. And the obligation to mercy comes from the teachings of Jesus. Now, we're going through the Beatitudes, and we're going through this preamble to the Sermon on the Mount, one of the most doctrinally full periods of teaching in the Gospels. This is where Jesus is. This is like the book of Romans is to Paul, the Sermon on the Mount is to Jesus. This is where Jesus lays out his theology of what it means to be in the kingdom of God. And so he gives examples of what that life is going to look like, and he lays out principles for the people to follow. And he begins it with this statement of blessings. He begins it with this statement that describes what people in the kingdom will look like. We looked at the first four, these principles of emptiness on the inside, the people that are poor in spirit, inheriting the kingdom of God, and we looked at what that meant. And now we're going to kind of move down the list and look at some of these other ones in the next couple of weeks. And the one that we're at now is that the very next beatitude regards mercy. And Jesus tells his disciples, blessed are the merciful, because they will receive mercy. Merciful people are blessed because they will be shown mercy. And to understand what this means, we have to realize that mercy begins in the heart. And it grows out of the first four Beatitudes. It grows out of an appropriate understanding of who we are, what we're capable of, and what our relationship to God is. Mercy is one of the great themes in the Old Testament. If you read through the Psalms, if you read through the first five books of the Bible, mercy comes back over and over and over again. And we don't think that. When we think Old Testament, we think God of justice, God of wrath, angry God. That's what you think when you think of the Old Testament. But that's the paradox in the Old Testament. God talks wrath, 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 and God does mercy, mercy, mercy. He says, I'm going to utterly destroy you, Israel. And then he gives them chance after chance after chance. And when you think he shouldn't give them another chance, he gives them another chance. Over and over and over again. In Exodus 34:6, this paradox is described by Moses. It says, then the Lord, and this is when Moses is receiving the Ten Commandments. This is the preamble to the Ten Commandments. This is God announcing himself. Like, I want you to think about that when the king comes out and they blow the trumpets and they start declaring the attributes and the names of the king, you know, Lord of this and King of that. This is what's happening here. Then the Lord came down from the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name. The Lord is proclaiming his name. And he passed in front of Moses proclaiming, the Lord, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sins of the parent to the third and fourth generation. See, God is a righteous God with a firm moral standard. He does not leave sin unpunished. But he is a loving and a gracious God who withholds the punishment until it can finally be paid by his son. That's the paradox there. He is both righteous and just and merciful and loving. Adam defies him in the garden and he doesn't kill him and start over. Israel defies him over and over and over again in the desert and he never wipes them out. He is always receptive to the cry of his people. So many times in the Psalms, the psalmist will come out and say, "Remember, Lord, your great mercy and your love, for they are from of old. Do not remember my sins, the sins of my youth." The sins of my youth. I love that, because I had many sins in my youth. "Do not remember the sins of my youth, my rebellious ways. According to your love, remember me, for you, Lord, are good." See, he holds judgment and stays his wrath until he can spend it on his own son. He pulls them up out of the miry pit. And this balance of justice and mercy is probably one of the most defining attributes of God. It is one of the things that defines our vision of God from everyone else's. Every other religion out there has a conception of God, and they conceive of him as being powerful and being all present and everywhere. But they don't have the balance of mercy and justice, of a God who is willing to forgive and forgive and forgive, and yet still uphold what is righteous and just. And God calls us to emulate this character. And somehow, at the time when Jesus came, the people of God looked at this attribute of God and completely missed it, which shouldn't surprise us, because that's what religious people usually do. We look at God and we gravitate towards the aspect of God that is the most terrible and the least appropriate for us to emulate. We want to emulate the righteous judge aspect of God. I want you to think about that. Broken, forgiven sinners want to be the righteous judge. So you got a God who exhibits two different kind of characteristics, and we're like, well, we want to be the one that lays down law. We want to be the one that holds accountable and stands on principle. See, God is a lawgiver and a terrible judge, and because it is our nature to want to be God, that's the side of him that we emulate. We want the power. We don't want the mercy side. The religious leaders at the time of Jesus tended towards being merciless because their demand for rigorous observance of the law was untainted with the justice and the mercy of God. Their motive was commendable. I mean, it wasn't like they were in a bad place. It wasn't like they were trying to fall away from God. They were responding to 1,000 years of idolatry in their people. Right? They're responding to everything you read in the book of Judges and Kings and Chronicles, where the people of God fell away and built altars to other gods and prostituted themselves. Right? That's what they're responding to. But in responding to that, they went so far in the opposite direction that they couldn't see mercy, that they couldn't conceptualize what it meant. They were unbending. But over and over and over again in the Old Testament, God tells his people that above sacrifice or ritual or law, that he desires his people to worship him through the emulation of his key character, mercy. That's why in Micah 6:8 he says, "What shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God?" This is the prophet Micah trying to tell the people what it means to truly worship. He says, "Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased by thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgressions, the fruit of my body, for the sin of my soul?" He's saying, what does God desire from me in worship? Does he want everything that I have? Does he want my
me to sacrifice my children in the fire? He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Hosea says it this way, what can you do? What can I do with you, Ephraim? What can I do with Judah, the two halves of the separated kingdom? Your love is like the morning mist, like the early dew that disappears. Therefore, I cut you into pieces with my prophets. I killed you with the words of my mouth. Then my judgments go forth like the sun, for I desire mercy, not sacrifice, an acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings. This is the true nature of what worship means. This is what it means to be devoted to God. This is what it means to emulate God, to emulate the merciful nature of our God. The merciful person understands that we have been saved from the wrath of God. And they respond with compassion towards the people around them. Peter asked Jesus how many times he's supposed to forgive his brother. Right? How many times should I forgive my brother, God? And you know what he says? He says, he teaches them a parable. He says that there's this rich servant, and he has this huge debt. And the king calls him in to pay the debt, and he says, I can't pay it. I can't pay it, Lord. Give me some time. Give me some more time. Right? Give me some more time, and I'll pay it off. And the king looks at him and says, your debt's forgiven. Then the servant goes out and finds somebody else that owes him like $100. And he says, give me what you owe me. You owe it to me. He throws him into jail and sells his kids and his wife into slavery to pay the debt. And when the king finds out, pulls the servant back in and says, you ungrateful servant, I forgave you much and you can't forgive little. And he throws him into jail where he will stay until he can pay the whole debt. See, Jesus wants them to understand that they who have been forgiven much have much to forgive. See, Christian mercy comes from an understanding of what our nature is. Every one of us have been forgiven an unimaginably huge debt. A debt that we cannot even conceptualize. And it is that forgiveness that is supposed to trickle down to other people. So I'm standing here in the street looking at this kid. And you know what's going through my mind? Every single stupid thing that I have ever done in my life, and I have done plenty of stupid, stupid things. I mean really dumb, dumb things. Stuff where I should have gone to jail, stuff where somebody should have shot me. And I'm looking at this kid, and I think to myself, I cannot call the cops on this guy. I just can't do it. I cannot call the cops on him. And so I didn't. I showed him mercy. See, mercy begins in the heart, but it doesn't stay in the heart. Right? It's not a warm feeling. It's not like a really neat, hey, this is all going to be okay kind of feeling. Mercy has to leave the heart and become action, or it's nothing. The first four Beatitudes are internal qualities. They are qualities that rest within the human heart, but mercy is the outpouring of the first four into the world. It is the shining of the light of God to the people that are out there. It's exhibiting the mercy that you've received, the forgiveness that you've received. It's reflected forgiveness is what it is. Once during Jesus' ministry, a lawyer came to him and asked him how he could be saved. You know, in the book of Luke, we find this a lot. People coming up to Jesus saying, hey, you know, teacher, how can I be saved? And Jesus' response is usually something like, well, what does the law say, genius? Right? You're a lawyer. You're a teacher of the law. What's the law say? He says, well, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus is like, okay, that's pretty simple.
But then the lawyer does what lawyers usually do. He tries to overcomplicate it. He does what we do when we come in contact with a rule that we don't want to follow. We try to throw out stipulations. We try to confuse it and make it more complicated. We try to take a black and white issue and blur that line so it's gray, right? Because we can hide in that gray zone. So he says, "Well, who's my neighbor? You know, who am I supposed? I mean, it says my neighbor, but." I mean, that the guy that lives next to me, I live in the country. I don't have any neighbors, you know? I mean, and so Jesus looks at him and goes, and you can just see the eyebrow raise, like, really? This is what we're going to do? Okay. And he tells him the story of the Good Samaritan. Right? He says that there's this guy who's walking down the road. He gets mugged by robbers. And they strip him of his clothes and they beat him and they went away, leaving him half dead. And a priest happened to be going down the same road. It's a priest, right? This is the religious guy. This is the religious of the religious, the most holy of the people in Israel. And he saw the man and he passed by on the other side of the road. So to a Levite, so not quite as good as a priest, but still pretty good. The chosen tribe, the tribe that's chosen to serve God. When he came to the place, he saw him and passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. Now, a Samaritan, we've talked about what these guys were before. This is a hated, mongrel half-breed. This is a representation of the sin of Israel. These are the people that reminded Israel of the fact that they've been conquered by the nations around them, resettled, and made impure. Everybody hated the Samaritans. They hated them so much that they fought wars with them. They burned down their temple on Mount Gerizim, and the Samaritans hated the Jews. It was equal. This would have been like saying a Pakistani member of Al-Qaeda walked down the street and saw you in a gutter. That's the way the effect would have been. But the Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and he saw him. He took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense he may have. And so Jesus looks at the man and says, which one of these guys was his neighbor? And the lawyer, knowing that he's been cornered and beaten, says, well, the one that showed him mercy. And so Jesus says, go and do likewise. Go and do likewise. The law and the prophets is summed up in 2 commandments. Love God and love your neighbor. And by love your neighbor, it means love everyone. Regardless of race, creed, religion, everyone. Mercy does not remain in the heart. It's an action. It's not a feeling. It's something that has to come out of us. It's not enough to stay on the side of the road and say, oh man, that's really bad. I can't believe that happened. Dude, did you see that? Oh man. It's not enough. One of the things that really bothers me is I start to see this now. People say, well, you know, we're going through a hard time. Please send good thoughts our way. What is a good thought? Seriously? A good thought? You want my good thoughts? Really? I mean, we say like, oh, at least lie to me and say you're going to pray for me. Right? At least say, oh, man, brother, I'm going to pray for you. Like, really? You're going to pray for me? Okay, sure you are. Yeah, okay. But my good thoughts mean nothing. My good thoughts mean nothing. They don't, I mean, that's part of this idea that you know, when we pray, you know, we think good thoughts, they like fly out of us and they go into the ether and touch the overmind of the earth goddess. And then she does, I mean, what is that? Prayer does something because it invokes the power of God, and we know that prayer works. Okay? But good thoughts don't mean anything. Mercy is not sending good thoughts their way or feeling bad for somebody else. Mercy is tangible. It's real. It's binding up wounds. It's picking somebody up out of the gutter, binding their wounds and paying their way and taking care of them. That's what mercy is. Make no mistake. God has two major commandments, and one of them is to get out there and love other people. The only person on that road that obeys God was the man who crossed to pick him up. The man who shouldn't have obeyed God. The guy who was from a totally different group that didn't even worship God the right way. James says it this way: suppose a brother or a sister is without clothes or daily food. If one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and well fed, but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is that? See, mercy is directed at all people everywhere, and it's tangible. Or it's not mercy. We have got to train ourselves to have eyes to see the people around us. Part of the problem with showing mercy is that we cocoon ourselves up so that we don't see the bad things that happen in this world. We live in this Christian bubble. We drive as fast as we can in our cars with the windows rolled up and the doors locked and the Christian radio station as loud as we can make it. Or AC/DC, I mean, just whatever. Okay? You know, we drive up to the bum on the side of the road and we don't look, we don't make eye contact with him. We don't look at him. We're going, you know, look now, count and change, whatever. We live next to people that we don't know their names. Or if we do know their names, we just kind of pass them every now and then and we have this superficial microwave relationship where everything's broken down to a 5-minute conversation. How are you? I'm fine. What's going on? Oh, everything's great. That's cool. Well, guess what, guys? Most people, everything is not great. Most people are living right at the edge of falling apart. And we have to train ourselves to see that. We have to train ourselves to be able to see the needs that are out there if we are going to love them the way that Christ has called us to love them. This means developing relationships with people that are deep. Being able to ask a person, how are you doing, and understand that we're going to get a response that may not be 5 minutes long. That's the problem. When you get deep with somebody, when you have a real relationship with them, they're going to suck you into their screwed up life. And there's going to be drama. They're going to be getting beat by their husband, or their kids are going to be taking drugs, or something's going to be a problem. And it's those situations that we are called to enter in and show mercy and love. If you develop close relationships with people, they are going to hurt you. They're going to cheat you or do something stupid or talk about you behind your back. And that gives us the opportunity to show them the mercy of love and forgiveness. That's what we're called to do. We've got to be bold in helping people. It's not enough to see a need and think, man, that person needs some help. I wish I could help them. Right? You know, the key example for me is always, I try to stop and help people on the side of the road. Right? That's what I try to do. That's the ministry that I try to, you know, that I had going to work. If somebody broke down on the side of the road, I try to stop and help them. But to do that, you've got to discern in an instant. Is it somebody I want to help? Can I help them? Do I have time? And then get over to the side of the road before you get killed by the people that are doing 90 behind you. Okay? And what that has trained me to is the fact that I have to be receptive to the calling of God on my life, because God will make me turn around if I'm supposed to stop and I didn't. And that's a pain, because sometimes there's not another exit for 5 miles. You got to go down, go all the way back, come back. And the person looks at you like you're a stalker, like, what are you doing? Right? If your neighbor is having a hard time, you need to get involved. If you see somebody that's hurting or in pain, get involved. You could be the hands of God in their life. Everybody here has had somebody who has spoken to them or served them in a time of need, and it was like, God, man, God, put that person in my life. You can be that person to somebody else. You can step out and do that.
We've got to be wise about it, though. I mean, I'm not telling, you know, we got ladies out here. I'm not telling you to stop on the side of the road and help random men change their tires, okay? I mean, you got to be smart about it. Guys, you're not supposed to go out and witness to prostitutes, okay? I would recommend that you not go out by yourself and pick up prostitutes and witness to them. That's not a good idea, okay? You're not going to rescue anybody. You're going to get in a lot of problems. I mean, maybe that's the excuse. You know, Pastor, I'm in jail. No, I was witnessing. Oh, okay. No, whatever. Okay. Whatever. Be wise about what you're doing. Don't cast your pearls before swine. But don't hide from it. Think about it. Look for discernment from God. Ask God what he wants you to do. And be open to his leading. But I think the most important thing for us to remember here, though, is that this mercy that we are showing is not some kind of payment that we're giving to God. You know, it says the merciful person is blessed because he will be shown mercy, right? The merciful people are blessed. They're going to be shown mercy. But God is not saying here that mercy or acts of mercy are like your ticket that are going to get you into heaven. They're not what's going to get you through the gate. We got tons of people out there who show mercy. You got Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. I don't know what the state of their heart is. I don't know. They're out there. They've adopted like 15 kids, and they dig wells everywhere. Okay? The secular world is filled with people who do acts of mercy. And quite frankly, they do them better than we do. Bono's out there. He does all kinds of stuff. Right? He flies in Africa and gives out AIDS medication. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. None of those things are going to be enough before God to save them. See, Jesus is explicit. Mercy is a core value in the kingdom. And when he speaks to the Pharisees, his main criticism of them is that they're not merciful. And then there's this chilling scene in Matthew where the people of the earth are standing before Jesus in his judgment seat. And he said, and he describes it, he says, then he will come and say to those, so people on the right, people on the left, righteous on the right, damned on the left, he say to the people on the left, depart from me, you who are cursed into eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger and you didn't invite me in. I needed clothes and you didn't clothe me. I was sick and in prison and you did not look after me. And they will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison? And you didn't help you. And he will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you do for the least one of these, you do for me. And whatever you don't do for them, you don't do for me. And then they will go away into eternal punishment. We treat the poor and the sick the way we are supposed to treat Christ. We look at the bum on the street like he's Christ. That's what we're supposed to do. If we shun them, we shun Christ. If we love them, we love Christ. The priest and the Levite in the story of the Samaritan pass on the other side of the street because they are upright in their own eyes. Because through their uprightness, they look down at these other people. They think that they are blessed by God. They have found satisfaction in the pleasures of this life and false comfort in a counterfeit God, their own righteousness. They see a need and they don't meet it because they don't truly feel the mercy of God on their own life. Jesus is clear what will happen to people like this. In Luke, he says, but woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you, for that is how their ancestors treated the false prophets. This is about a heart condition. This is about what the state of your heart is. Do you feel justified by the things that you are doing? Do you feel righteous? Because if you do, you will not
show mercy. If you feel like you are a Christian because of your own righteousness, if you feel that you have been made right before God because things that you have done, you will always treat those less fortunate than yourself with contempt, because they must be sinners or God would bless them. This isn't works-based salvation. This is salvation causing good works. This is the outgrowth of a person's faith. We are saved by faith through grace, not through any act of our own. That's what the first four Beatitudes say. Dale Bruner says it this way: salvation or forgiveness is an unmerited gift of grace. But where this salvation and forgiveness are not passed on to others, there is judgment. Being merciful, forgiving, or loving is not a condition of God's grace. It is the necessary consequence of it. We're saved by faith through grace, through the free gift of God. But mercy confirms the work of the Holy Spirit in us. We are saved by faith through grace, but faith without works is a dead faith. It's a faith that doesn't mean anything. It's a faith that doesn't exist. John, 1 John says it this way: if anyone has material possessions and sees his brother or sister in need and has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? The merciful will be shown mercy because mercy flows from a heart changed by the love of God. They are not saved because they show mercy. They are saved. They show mercy because they are saved. Mercy is a fruit. It is a sign of a mind that is being conformed to the nature and attitude of Christ. Two weeks after my truck got totaled, I went down to meet with the family that had done it. And the meeting didn't really go well. They were cagey and they were being kind of shady about it. They were not, I didn't have a good feeling about it. I didn't feel comfortable that they were going to do what they said they were going to do, that they were going to fix my truck and make everything turn out right. And I, as I drove back from, it was down at Matt's shop. I was driving back from Matt's shop and I was mad. I was like, I showed these people mercy and they're cheating me. I'll show these people mercy. I was mad. I was mad at God. Because God told me to show them mercy. And I said, you told me to show them mercy and they're treating me like this. Like, you're supposed to bless this. What are you doing? Get on the stick, God. I mean, seriously, what are you doing something else? I was scolding God. Telling him that he needed to make this right. You need to be careful when you scold God. You need to be real careful when you scold God. Job scolded God. God spoke to him out of the whirlwind. God kind of spoke to me. He said, really? Gird yourself up like a man. Let me ask you some questions about mercy. This mercy that you're showing him. See, mercy is not giving them a little extra time to pay you what is owed. That's not what God does with us. He doesn't say, hey, you know what? Take a couple more years, get your life straight, and then we'll be good. Then you can have some salvation. That's not what God does. Mercy is saying, you owe me a debt. You have violated me. The debt's forgiven. That's what mercy is. He looked at me and said, how could you possibly be so pompous and self-righteous to stand there and question me about this?
I said, oh, that's ridiculous. I can't forgive a debt like that. It's a lot of money. It's a truck. And then I realized mercy is ridiculous. Mercy doesn't make sense. Mercy is the total antithesis of the world that we in. It's not getting what you're owed. It's forgiving a debt. It's taking on the damage that another person does because they are careless. Because that's what Christ does for us. Mercy is foolishness in the world's eyes because God is foolishness in the world's eyes. Now, I will tell you, brothers and sisters, if you've come in here and you are crushed under the weight of your own righteousness, if you've spent your life carefully working out all the things that you're supposed to do because you're a good person, and you have built up this mountain of good works that you can look down from on everybody else, I want you to ask yourself this. What it's going to be like when you stand before God? What side are you going to be standing on? The right side or the left side? Are you going to be one of the sheep or are you going to be one of the goats? When God calls you in front of Him and asks you why you should be allowed into His kingdom, what good works are you going to point to? Because let me tell you what's going to happen. As soon as you stand before the Ancient of Days, all of those good works that you are so proud of are going to look like filthy rags. And they are going to burn away. Because there is nothing that makes us right before God except the blood of His Son. If you come in here today and you are crushed by a life spent making bad decisions, so many bad decisions you can't even count them, if you've gone down so many bad paths that you can't even figure out how to get back to the highway, that's what mercy is for. We have a God who loved you enough to die while you were a sinner for you. He is willing to pay the price for your sin. You don't have to be good enough. You don't have to build up righteous deeds to earn your way in. All you have to do is be contrite and brokenhearted, and God will forgive you. If you are a Christian, if you have been saved, I want you to remember what it was like before you were saved. I want you to remember what your life was like before you were changed, and I want you to remember that there is no one who owes you a debt of righteousness. There is no goodness that we can claim on our own. There is no moral superiority that we can hold over anyone else. There is no principle that we get to stand on. We are those who have been broken and who have had everything paid for us. And it is our job to show that to the people around us. We are sinners who were saved in spite of who we are. We were saved by costly, ridiculous grace. And everything we do should reflect that. Please bow your heads with me. Dear sweet Jesus, God, thank you so much for all the blessings in our life. Thank you for the costly, ridiculous grace that you've shown us. God, I ask that you would help us to see the people around us the way that you see them. You help us to show grace the way you have shown it to us. God, I ask that we would be people with huge hearts for our community, for our family, for the people around us. God, I ask if there is anyone present in this room who does not know you, that you would come into their life in a real way, that you would save them. And Lord, I ask these things in your holy name. Amen. Brothers and sisters, in a moment, we're going to have a time of invitation. If you feel God working in your life, if you feel like you need to make a commitment, if you
want salvation or you want forgiveness for a life spent wasted, come forward and we will pray with you. If you're embarrassed, don't be. We're not a judgmental group here, but if you're too embarrassed to come forward, come and find me and I will talk to you and I will pray with you. Brothers and sisters, if you're looking for a place to live out this life, please join us. Join our church, because we're not perfect, but we love Jesus. And we want to love you.